Okay, so I do believe we're live.
Lovely. Hello, I'm Simon Mercep, and this is Crave, a podcast about films, music, television, anything else that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe in the last week or so.
And this week, we're going to be looking at Rogue One. It's not a Star Wars film, but it is a Star Wars story.
It is, and staying in space, but not quite as far, far away. We've a few thoughts to share about Passengers, what's turned out to be an extremely controversial space romance between Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt.
I know, who would have thought a space romance would kick up so much, but it has. And then coming back to Earth a little bit, I've seen Middle School, which I would have thought would have been a little throwaway, a little bit of a nothing of a film, but it was quite possibly the most entertaining thing I've seen all week.
Oh, I look forward to hearing about that. I didn't see it, so you can fill me in on that one, Steve. But let's start in a galaxy long, long...
Yeah, that one, yeah.
Far, far, that one.
That one.
Rogue One. I'll let you kick this one off. Is the Force strong with this film?
Should we just start with yes, just to get out of the way? It's good. It's very good.
I think
good.
It's good, too. Let me just quickly get that in. I think it's good. I think it's probably... the one I've enjoyed the most in many ways because it's a bit more adult. But you tell us a bit more about the background to the story.
Well, the background to the story, if you think about it, goes all the way back to 1977, all the way back to, you know, a long time ago when
yes.
when we had the famous opening crawl for what eventually became known as Episode 4, A New Hope, where it talks about rebels having captured the plans for the Death Star.
Right.
And so we've known that within the Star Wars universe, that event happened. We've known about that since 1977. So that's great. So we know that was coming. And so Disney decided that to pad out the time between the official canonical episodes within the Star Wars story arc, they were going to release Star Wars stories. These are little fillers. These are spin-offs. These are non-official, but they inhabit the same universe. And so Rogue One tells the story of how the rebels who are talked about in the crawl at the start of Episode 4, how they actually managed to capture the plans to the Death Star. And it turns out that they are the typical ragtag bunch of misfits that you expect in a film like this, led by the daughter of, oddly enough, one of the lead engineers on the Death Star. Because you forget this thing had to be built, and it had to have engineers and designers and folk working on it. And so So you've got an actual engineer chap by the name of Galen Erso. We're back on the weird names for the Star Wars characters.
We are.
So you've got Galen Erso, who was played quite nicely by Mads Mikkelsen as the lead engineer. And the film starts, actually, it's worth mentioning, with that rarest of things, cracking dialogue in a Star Wars film. I know those are two expressions that rarely go hand in hand, but this time they did. So it opens with this wonderful scene of Orson Krennic, who is he's in full Imperial officer uniform, arriving on this wilderness planet, and he's played by Ben Mendelsohn. He's trying to convince Erso to come back and carry on working on the Death Star. And that scene, it crackles with tension. It's absolutely beautifully done. And through all manner of peril and threat, he obviously gets Erso to go back. The whole scene is seen at a distance by his young daughter, Jyn Erso.
Yes. Yep.
Who then, as we leap forward in time as well as in space, then comes to be played as an adult rather splendidly by Felicity Jones.
Yes.
Who then gets caught up with a group of rebels who are going to try and snag these plans back. And so the story then unfolds of various, and let's be honest about this, too many rebel characters trying to get into the yet another planet. Because let's be fair, the start of the film is planet after planet after planet. It brought to mind Suicide Squad, where it couldn't throw enough characters at you.
Yes. I did get a little giddy at the beginning there, I have to say, jumping around from place to place. But never mind.
It was like a child with too much chocolate the day after Halloween to begin with. But once it settles down... Now, what were your impressions of the tone of the film at this point?
I liked that. I did get it. I thought they rushed things a little bit with all those, as you say, planet hopping. But it is a darker, for want of that word, and a grittier story than the other Star Wars films. I thought it was more of a grown-up film than a kid's film. I mean, I suppose you could say that many of the previous films had a jokey, fun, dare I say, at times juvenile aspect to some of the characters and the dialogue. That really isn't on display here, I thought, Steve, and I probably enjoyed that more because of it.
Yeah, you didn't miss the Ewoks then, did you?
I didn't miss the Ewoks. I didn't miss Jar Jar Binks.
No.
So that was good. and in fact, it did make me think of quite a few occasions during the course of the film. I'm sure because of the marketing these days, there's lots of young kids really looking forward to seeing this film. I'm not sure how much they'd enjoy the special effects, of course, but a number of aspects of the story is probably not for young kids especially, but as an aside. But I thought it worked pretty well. You mentioned Felicity Jones with the role she played, and she does do it very well. And I thought what was good was here's a character where you are told straight up, as you very aptly described, this is a kid who had a grim and extremely dark childhood. And as an adult, well, what do you know? She acts like someone who's had a grim and exceedingly dark childhood. She's not full of lightness and fluffiness at all. She's as you'd expect.
And yet she does refer constantly. And I found myself wondering, was this a callback to episode 4? She repeatedly talks about hope and never losing hope.
I mean, there's a bit of cynicism in the character early on, and there's a major scene where she is able to. There's an emotional scene which pivots her character on that road to hope, doesn't it? So that's good. I thought the other aspect about the characters, which you would not have seen in any other Star Wars film, and this has happened very early on, Steve. One of the I suppose you'd say the male counterpart or male foil for Jyn is Cassian. Cassian Andor. He's played by Diego Luna.
Yes.
Now, pretty early on, we see him acting in a pretty ruthless, a pretty cold-hearted way. It's all to the, you know, to further the greater cause of the rebellion. But it's deals out some harsh justice, harsh punishment. And I thought, gee, Han Solo would never have done that. Set that tone.
But we did see a little bit of that darkness, if you remember, in Episode 7 early on, where entire villages were laid waste.
Yes. That's true. I guess I'm thinking about the characters on the good side, if you like, who are we're seeing more of of a rounded nature to how they've been depicted, and it's not all black and white. And Cassian in particular is, I think that Diego Luna did a good job of showing the conflict in his character quite well during the course of the film.
Indeed. It's interesting that he managed to get so much out of it, because I did think in the end that the rebel band who go flying, and again, no spoilers here because it's in the trailer, who fly a stolen spaceship, which they give the call sign Rogue One to.
Yeah.
So the crew of Rogue One. It also include characters, again, with these wonderful names, Churrut Imwe and Baze Malbus, who quite frankly, I'll put it this way, could you imagine the story working without those characters in it?
No, I was going to come to them. Yeah, if there was any, I've talked about the darkness and all blah, blah, blah. If there was any characters who gave a bit of lightness and some comic element, it was those two, wasn't it? Played by Donnie Yen and Jiang Wen. I thought they were great, personally. I thought the way they bantered and sparked off each other, I really enjoyed. And Donnie Yen delivers some of the most spectacular, as you'd expect from a martial arts superstar, some of the most spectacular fighting sequences in the whole film. I liked them. Did you not like them?
I felt that they were unnecessary.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We mentioned earlier that we were bopping around from planet to planet, and kind of lost track of which planet you were on half the time. And I got a little bit of a sense of that the stage was too crowded with characters, and Imwe and Malbus could have been lost without any main real detriment to the story. Although, yeah, to be fair, like you say, you know, Imwe puts on a wonderful demonstration of what the Force can do.
Actually, just on that, Steve, this is where I would beg to differ with you a little bit, in that the Chirrut. Is it Chirrut? Chirrut character that's played by Donnie Yen.
Yeah, Chirrut Inwe.
We do see him talking about his relationship with the Force throughout his character arc. So I just took that to be kind of a constant reminder about the Force and about the possibilities of where how the Force could help you. So I saw a reason in him being there in that broader sort of way. It's not a very specific thing, but it sort of helped fit the whole story and that remind us of the what we're all about here with the Force and what it can do. Hey, what about the CGI? What did you make of that? In particular, the couple of characters who we see from a long time ago.
Well, there's one obviously that we shan't mention because no one's really talking about that one too much. But the one I have my notebook in front of me. I was taking notes as I do all the way through the film. And I did comment, Governor Tarkin looks and sounds a lot like Peter Cushing.
Isn't that funny?
and then eventually I discovered there was a reason for that.
Yes. But having said that, I mean, they did an incredible job, didn't they? It's an incredible technological feat of CGI, but you do know it's CGI, don't you?
Well, I just thought, this is so well done, I'm just going to go with it. Yes. In hindsight, yes, obviously, it had to be, because, you know, the man's been dead for 20 years. So you'd be hard-pushed for it not to be. And yet, it was quite brilliant that it was utterly believable. It was seamless.
Yeah, no, it was really well done. Yeah, excellently done. So overall, the other thing we must mention, can we mention a certain other dark character who's...
There's a couple of characters who still need mentioning. I know where you're going with this one, and he's in the trailer as well, so we can talk about him.
Okay, fair enough. You're talking about Darth Vader.
And voiced wonderfully by James Earl Jones. I can't get down there, no.
He must be getting on.
Yes, absolutely.
anyway, it's a by the by, but So there's a sequence there of him in action. Don't want to give too much away, but it's a pretty genuinely gripping sequence, I thought, and it really you get a hint of the power that we see later on in this film series. It was I thought that sequence was really, really well done.
There was one thing. Did you pick up on it? I don't know. One of the other two people I've spoken to did. When he first walks out of his, I don't know what room it is, but the chamber he occupies, and he marches out to encounter Galen Erso, and as he walked, I thought,
What did you see? I paid close attention to it, other than the fact I thought it was a bit jaunty.
Yes.
What else? Is that the thing that you picked up on, or is it something else?
I thought that Darth Vader does not sachet.
No. Okay.
There are many things this character does. He's the epitome of evil in the universe, and he's swaggering. And he just felt wrong.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting point. Yeah, it was like he was... yes, there wasn't enough...
menace.
So gravitas and menace to it. Yes, it was a little light.
Yeah, I mean, for Darth Vader, that was full-on mincing. now here's an interesting little bit of Star Wars trivia for you. The original the original body inside the suit was a British bodybuilder by the name of David Prowse. Now, he comes from the West Country in England, and he's got one of those really soft, really gentle voices. And when he speaks, he's got a really lovely voice. But nobody told him when he was making the film. No one told him he wasn't doing the voice for Darth Vader.
Oh.
And originally, he believed that he was going to be doing the voice. And so he thought that it was going to be, you know, Luke, I am your father. The Force is strong with this one. And he didn't know. And then when the film was released, suddenly you've got James Earl Jones being all magnificent and rich underneath it.
Yes.
But he was the original body inside the suit, and he did it with menace and gravitas. He just moved with so much presence. They've got two new fellas who are Vadering it up these days, and I don't think they occupied the character half as well as he did. But I really am being a Star Wars geek here now, aren't I? This is terrible.
Yeah, no, it's all right. And I just want to. We talked about the plot moving fast and a little hard to sometimes keep up with. And there's one thing I just wanted to mention briefly, and because it is quite important to the plot, I won't go into the details too much, but I think there was at least probably, I know there are geeks who spend hours combing movies looking for little problems with sequences and things that are out of kilter.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought there was one particular part of the plot towards the end that I found immediately struck me as being, hold on, that doesn't make any sense. It's to do, and I'll just put this very broadly, it's to do with the ability of the rebels to carry out an attack against an imperial position.
Yes.
And we see the first group of rebels encounter a difficulty with how they can access this, but later that difficulty all of a sudden disappears, and other rebels are able to do what the first lot couldn't do. And I immediately thought, hold on, that's not right. I hope I'm not giving too much away or being too vague here. But it just was an example where I just think someone forgot about what had happened earlier in the film. And for me anyway, unless there was an explanation which I missed, which is possible, I thought it was a glaring error.
Now, I think what you're talking about, this is when the waves of fighter jet things come flying in. I was too busy paying attention to the fact that, and as it turns out, I was actually right with this. I didn't realise at the time. I kept thinking a lot of the footage of the pilots of the starfighters, mm-hmm. I thought, looked... Hang on a sec.
Yep. I can hear a little noise.
Yeah, there's a phone call coming in that I can't take right now.
Right. Okay.
I'll edit that bit out. So,
yes.
You've got all the starfighters coming in, and there's close-ups of the faces of the pilots.
Yes.
And I was thinking, there's something looks a bit incongruous about this, and it turns out that was actually unused footage from the original films.
You're kidding.
No,
wow.
Those were bits of film from the 1970s from the original attack on the original Death Star. So I was so focused on that, thinking, these are the original pilots. The colour balance, something about the image quality, that just looked like it looked dated. And it turns out that that's what it was. So I was distracted there a little bit. So yeah.
Okay. Actually, we should finish by just briefly talking about the overall look of the film. And you know, I mean, I thought it was, given what you've just said, it really is an impressive tableau they've come up with, and there are some great special effects, and I thought it worked very, very well in that regard, as we expect from a lot of modern sci-fi films these days.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, there is also one thing that we have to mention that we've not. You were talking about comic relief and comic sidekicks. We have to mention the robot.
Ah, okay, yes. Yeah, that's a good point. Because that was a far cry from C-3PO and whatever.
R2-D2.
Yes, that's what I'm looking for.
Everyone knows that one, come on. This is K-2SO, who's a stolen Imperial droid who's been captured by the Rebels and reprogrammed, but still has an awful lot of his knowledge of the Empire. Voiced by Alan Tudyk, who last time I saw was in a sitcom called Suburgatory. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's very, very funny.
I'm not familiar with that.
It's an American sitcom. It's quite dark. It's worth a look. He's in that, and he voices K-2SO, who is a snarky teenager of a robot.
Yes, and And it's refreshing, isn't it? It's refreshing to have an adult sort of take on that sort of a character, which previously in so many of the other stories in this universe is anything but adult. It's more juvenile. So I thought, I really enjoyed him. It was great.
Yeah,
a lovely foil.
At the screening I was at, people were laughing out loud at some of his comments. He was genuinely funny. He reminded me in particular of, if you're familiar with The Big Bang Theory, on many occasions, he was Sheldon Cooper.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed him. I thought he made it. So basically, in the end, I'm going to say Star Wars greatest hits.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's fair. I definitely recommend, if you've got a passing interest in these stories, definitely worth a ticket. Don't take young kids to it, I would say. Would you agree with that, Steve?
I think it's dark enough. And there are certain outcomes that we shan't mention that are not right for a young audience. What would you say, 10, 12 at the earliest?
Yeah, something around there. Don't take a 6-year-old or something like that. I wouldn't have thought that.
Oh, absolutely. Even though they'll want you to.
Yeah, they will. That's the problem. They will. Anyway, but so generally, a bit of a tick from both of us.
I'd buy a ticket for that one, definitely.
Yeah, likewise. Very good. Okay, so look, this is Crave, by the way. He's Steve McCabe. I'm Simon Mercer. We've actually got a bit of a science fiction theme going this week. We've just talked about Rogue One. But this next film doesn't open here in New Zealand. It's already opened elsewhere, but it doesn't open here until New Year's Day. And this being Crave's last episode of the year, let's start talking about Passengers, Steve.
Yes.
It's a first thing to say is if you've even had a bit of a cursory look around the film or arts pages on your favourite news websites, you'll have seen quite a bit written about this film. It's caused quite a controversy straight away for two reasons, as far as I can make out. The first is that people seem angry that the film does not, it turns out to be really not much to do with how it's depicted in the trailer. So there seems to be quite a lot of disgruntlement around about the fact that, hey, well, this isn't what we signed up for. The other really and probably more critical aspect of the criticism, before I just quickly get to the story, is just to set the stage here, Steve, is that the people are really upset, livid, that this film is, without giving too much away, in some way celebrating or, yeah, that's not quite the right word, but celebrating something in human nature it should be vilifying.
Yes, very fair.
Yeah, you know, so we'll come back to that, but the people feel that the film is holding up something, a way of acting that is just despicable, and it should not do that. Anyway, let's just go back quickly to the story. Just quickly, we won't get into it too much because it hasn't opened here in New Zealand yet. But basically, you've got a spaceship, again, on a long-distance voyage to a new planet with 5,000 civilians and a few hundred crew. And this is a ship that's going to set up a new human colony on another planet. It's run by a private company. And all the people, all of them initially, are in hibersleep, a hibernation. It's all run on by computer. And the story starts, and you'll get this from the trailer, that the character played by Chris Pratt, who is James, everyone calls him Jim, wakes up. And James Preston is his name. So the question is, why did he wake up? What is he going to do when he wakes up? And that leads to some serious questions that his character has to confront over quite a few months. I think I can say that. And we do then later lead to the appearance in the story of the second major character, an author called Aurora Lane, played by Jennifer Lawrence. So that most of the film plays out as what's going on between these two characters. It's a beautifully weighted and timed cameo, more than a cameo, supporting performance by Michael Sheen, the English actor Michael Sheen, who plays the barman called Arthur.
I'm going to have to stop you for a second.
Yeah.
He's Welsh.
Thank you for pointing that out.
There'll be
the criticism from the valleys from now as we speak.
Yes. Oh, gosh. I can't let that one slide, sorry.
No, you shouldn't. You shouldn't. My apologies to the good people of Wales. So basically, we've got it's a sci-fi mystery thriller, but certainly romance as well. But you're not quite sure what's going to happen, I'd say. You are kept on the back foot a little bit. I didn't mind that. I thought that was quite good. Yeah, I'm being a bit cautious here on how much I'm giving away. But let's just say that's the setup anyway. The two main characters, man and woman, on the spaceship. Everyone else is in hibernation. How do they wake up? Why are they potentially in danger? How are they going to resolve it? That's the basic core of the story, I suppose.
And I think you ought to be commended for the deftness with which you skirted potential spoilers there, because I'm inclined to give a bit more detail, but
go on, where you go.
But should we? I mean, it's not. I mean, you're right. The film that's depicted in the trailer, the film that's depicted on posters, pivots on one particular word in one sentence that doesn't appear in the film, that changes very much and takes out a central, pivotal, and profoundly transgressive act of violation.
Yes, Yes, well phrased, Mr. McCabe. Yes,
we're being delicate here, aren't we?
Yeah. I don't want to spoil it for people because there are some genuine surprises in the story when you get to see it. So I don't want to give too much away. I mean, if you really want to go, find some websites and find out more about it, you can. But we will treat you with some respect and hope that you you can see the film and form your own opinions. Can we just deal with the trailer issue, Steve?
Yeah.
Because I don't know how you feel about this. I'm actually really happy for any trailer, not just this one, any trailer, not to give too much away. And even to the point, I was just pondering this, even to the point that I don't mind actually being misled if it means that the experience of watching the whole movie means I'm in for a surprise. Because the last thing I want is to go into a film knowing what to expect. So, in some ways, the fact that there's no doubt, I think, that you are led up the garden path by the trailer, in some ways I'll forgive them that because I then got some genuine surprises and twists and turns in the actual film.
Okay, I can
so
go that, with that.
That's my take. That's my take on that part of it anyway.
No, I think you're profoundly forgiving.
Okay.
I think you're cutting them a bit of slack. I mean, there have been films recently which have been very misleading in their trailers. I mean, Suicide Squad led us to believe it was going to be good. So you have to be very careful how you sell a film like that.
Yes.
So we'll let that go. And it draws us in. We see the pictures of Pratt and Lawrence on the posters. And they're both impossibly gorgeous. So we think, yeah, I want to see a film with those two in. So if we just deal with it on that level, how well did they work together?
Okay. I think my opinion, and slightly different coming from just different positions. I mean, I think Jennifer Lawrence has pretty well established her acting chops by now for a young person. She's won an Oscar, or is it two? No, she's at least won one Oscar.
Yes.
And she's extremely accomplished. And I don't think she lets down any of her previous performances by what she does here. I thought I was slightly more pleasantly surprised by Chris Pratt. We've seen him in some big budget action adventure movies like Jurassic World and Guardians of the Galaxy. He was in that Magnificent Seven remake not that long ago, Steve.
Yes, he was, wasn't he?
Yeah. But I thought that he brought a bit more to the table on this film, especially early on where he has to command one's attention fully. I thought there was enough going on with what you were seeing him having to deal with to make – I thought his my rating of his acting ability went up a little bit in that, especially in that first part. Because you really the moral dilemma starts with him.
Yes, in many ways it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And he sort of depicts a slow descent into madness.
Yeah.
That I thought was quite deftly done, whereas when Jennifer Lawrence's character, Aurora, wakes up, she just loses the plot immediately, which I think, to be fair, you would. I mean, I can't fault
you. Would. I think,
you
no,
can't fault
no,
the
you
character
would.
For that.
No, you would, wouldn't you? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because, I mean, let's talk about the actual numbers that they give in the film. It's worth mentioning just to give an idea of the magnitude of the problem they're facing. Supposedly, it's a 120-year journey, which is why they're in hibernation.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to wake up 4 months from the end of it. And they actually wake up 80 years from the end of it.
Yes.
So when you wake up and that realization hits you in the face, then, yeah, you're not going to handle that with the greatest degree of magnanimity.
No.
And they don't. And so for the first significant chunk of the film, when it's still being The Martian, effectively, then you've got Chris Pratt pretty much carrying it on his own.
Yeah, yeah.
With, as you say, though, fantastic, fantastic support from Michael Sheen.
Yeah, it's great.
Does bring a beautiful amount, just exactly the right amount of very dry humour.
Yeah, no, it's a bit like we were just talking about the robot in Star Wars. There's that level of sophistication and in a way, it was really good. So let's, as best we can, Steve, we better deal with this this unsettling aspect of where how the story turns, and we're not going to give away what it is, but I think there's been a great deal of, I think the outrage would not be too soft a word to use by some people saying, how dare they base the premise of a film on one character acting in such a way.
Yeah.
But that is the core of the story.
It is.
So if you took that away, you'd have a completely different film and a different story. So, what are those critics saying? That you can't tell a story that has where one actor, one character acts in a way which you don't approve of. I mean, this is a drama. It's a drama. It's a made up story.
It would wipe out the entire oeuvre of Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, basically, all we'd ever be able to read is Enid Blyton at that point.
There has to be peril.
I think this comes back to the way the film was sold, and it sold almost. Well, I don't know. My issue is it's how many different films is it realistically? It is The Martian to begin with.
Yeah,
we've got elements of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's basically the Golgo Frincham arc. We've got. It reminded me of the picture, the image, the visual style reminded me of 2001 in places. Mm-hmm. It then becomes a rom-com for a while.
Yes,
just briefly. Then it flirts with Gravity, but can't quite commit to being Gravity.
Yeah.
There's a number of different films in here, and the trailer manages then to tell us it's another film altogether.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the issue, is by all means, have a film about someone who does something extraordinarily transgressive. The whole nature of a good film is there has to be tension, which, incidentally, just to go off on a wee bit of a tangent, and again, avoiding spoilers, other than what we're talking about right now, there's no bad guy.
How do I put that? No obvious bad guy, although if you listen to the critics... there is a bad guy,
but that's a different question altogether. There's no enemy that they're fighting, that has to be defeated. So there's a number of different films being played out here, except the film that's been depicted in the trailers.
I mean, fair enough. I just come back to the fact that I'd be quite happy to do without trailers, so I don't mind. But anyway, that's just me.
No, I can see where you're going with that.
And I think clearly that's why so many people are upset.
Yes.
Can we just very quickly? I do think for all the moral dilemma and the degree of an unpleasant aspect to the way one character behaves, at the end, the story, you could argue, loses its nerve.
Oh yes.
In a way that perhaps the Star Wars film Rogue One didn't. And that in itself presents another moral dilemma, actually, about how the other character responds to the hurt that's been committed against them. So that was a really interesting. It didn't seem the most appropriate ending in many ways to me. It seemed like a rather too nicely wrapped up piece of work, but you could argue that in itself is just as disturbing as what happened before. So you're right.
I mean, if you sort of play it out as a sort of a psychological thriller,
try
and shed there are definite rom-com aspects to it, and if you can sort of let go of those, enjoy the spectacular set piece special effects footage.
Yes.
Like, for example, and again, it's in the trailer, there's one bit of Jennifer Lawrence swimming in zero gravity.
Oh, yeah.
Set aside the fact that the physics of that is utter bollocks, and just embrace it as a sort of a psychological exploration of the dark places that a terrible situation can take a person's soul.
Yes.
And you see, view it on that level, there's actually a hell of a good film in there.
I agree. I think that's what it is. I mean, it's dressed up. You're right. There's lots of other things that have been wrapped around it and the way it's been marketed. But essentially, it's exactly that. It is a psychological, moral film. And I think my advice, for what it's worth, would be don't be put off by all the criticism you've read. I think you should see it and make up your own mind, because it's one of those ones that will divide people, I suspect. And it'd be really interesting for you to get your own take on it.
And if you do see it, please let us know. There's one question that bugged me all the way through it. Why is it that if Jim Preston can eat in every restaurant on the ship, different restaurants every night, get unlimited booze from the Arthur the Robot bartender, played by Michael Sheen, the Welshman, he can get unlimited booze from those guys. Why is it they can only get an economy class breakfast?
That is a searing question, and I don't have an answer for you.
Troubled me all the way through the film.
Okay. All right. But so, that given...
Would you buy a ticket?
I would. I definitely would. Yes, absolutely.
I think I would too. In fact, I'm tempted to go and see it again, just to see if I view it in any other way, having dissected it to the extent that we have.
Yeah. Because I think if you hadn't seen the trailer, you'd be in for quite a ride. And
yes.
You'd be in for a number of surprises. And
yes.
I think you'd take quite – you'd be thinking about it quite a while afterwards about what – like this is the question it asks you. It asks you, what would you do?
Oh.
If you were in that character's position, what would you do? And I think that's a good question to ask someone, and there'll be different answers depending on who you are. Right. All right, enough of the philosophy.
Let's lighten the mood, Simon. Lighten the mood.
Yes, we shall. We shall. Now, you've been to a film which I haven't seen, but I recall you mentioning at the beginning of the podcast, Steve, you really enjoyed this one. It's called Middle School. Tell me about that, please.
Well, this is at the other end of the spectrum from your Rogue Ones and your Passengers. It's very, very – it's under the radar compared to those two. So it's a very low-key little film. Set in, obviously, a middle school. It's a very, very American phenomenon of early teens who are struggling with emotions and hormones and you name it, they're struggling with it. And so the central character is Rafe, played brilliantly by a young lad named Griffin Gluck. And he's been kicked out of a couple of schools and he's finally sent to the last school that'll take him, where the law is laid down in an absolutely draconian law book by Principal Dwight, played quite wonderfully by Andrew Daly, who's clearly having a lot of fun in his role.
Yeah.
In the meantime, his mother, Jules, played by Lauren Graham. Now, are you a Gilmore Girls fan, Simon?
Actually, I just haven't watched it, to be honest with you. I know it's obviously very popular and it's been around for a while, hasn't it? It's just one of those shows I just haven't sat down and ever watched. So
for obvious reasons.
Well, anyway,
I sat there watching the film and as the mother Jules was on the screen for a while, I turned to my wife and said, "I know her, don't I?" She said, "Yeah, she's the mother from the Gilmore Girls." So it's Lauren Graham plays the mother, who's the father is out of the picture, as they often are in films like this. We don't quite know what's happened to the father. He's gone. And so she's taken up with Carl, who's a complete oaf, hates the children, played very one-dimensionally, actually, by Rob Riggle, who was having way more fun with the role than we were having with it, because he just played it as an absolute oaf. So Rafe decides, in conjunction with his sidekick Leo, who also appears to have followed him from other schools, that they're going to have some fun. They're going to figure out a way of breaking every single rule in the book.
Yes.
And so it plays out that way. The whole thing is, the story's thin. It doesn't matter because it's played really, really beautifully. Griffin Gluck, as I say, is fantastic as Rafe. He's got just the right combination of innocence and snark that just works beautifully. He's then got Georgia, his little sister, played by Alexa Nissenson, who again has the wide-eyed innocence combined with absolute venom. It's very, very hard balance to pull off, but somehow they manage it. And of course, there's always going to be a little bit of a love interest. And so there's a young lady named Jeannie who he finds himself falling in with. And you know exactly from the moment she walks on the screen how that one's going to play out. But it doesn't matter because it's how it gets there. It's one of these wonderful films where it's not about the destination, because the destination's obvious. Except there's one little wrinkle that we won't talk about very cheesy, very contrived plot twist that does kind of work. Along the way, you've got Adam Pally plays Mr. Teller, Rafe's teacher.
Yes.
Who is absolutely brilliant. First time I saw him, he was in another American sitcom called Happy Endings. Plays Rafe's teacher with just the right amount of, again, he's sympathetic, but at the same time aloof. He manages to play it just right. There's a very difficult line he has to tread, and I think he does it very, very nicely. And this is just a very, very sweet film without ever crossing the line. It comes bloody close in places. Never quite crosses the line into saccharine or schmaltz. Just right, and I loved it.
Okay. Oh, very nice. That's always if a film can dance down that line and come on the right side of it, you leave feeling much better. And if it goes on the wrong side of that line, you have a churning feeling in your tummy afterwards.
It could have been so sickly. It really could. It could have been absolutely nauseating. And yet, all at the end of it, you're thinking, I enjoyed that. That was really nice. It opened in the US back in October, but seems to have managed to escape anybody's attention. It's finally coming out in New Zealand early in January, and I would recommend buy a ticket, go and see it, because it's lovely fun.
That's Middle School. Okay, good. Steve, we're moving on in our podcast here, but we should just talk briefly about a bit of music, having discussed some movies. There's been a lot of music, obviously, churning out. And one album I was decided I would be keen to have a listen to because of what was being said about it, and this is the new, can I say this in 2016, the new Rolling Stones album. It's called Blue and Lonesome. And what it is a collection of covers, of blues covers. I've heard the whole album. Have you had it? I know you've heard a couple of tracks, have you, Steve? Two or three?
I've played the whole thing once.
Oh, you have now? Okay. Well, what was your immediate impression?
My immediate impression is it reminded me of what an amazing songwriting duo Jagger and Richards are.
Actually, that's a very pertinent point because I've actually physically bought the actual album. And if when you go to the notes at the back, Steve, and you look at the history of the songs they've recorded, and as I say, covers written by seem to be most of them come from the 1950s, mid to late 50s. Listen to this, Steve. Here's one song. Who do Blues? Lightning Slim, that's the writer. Lightning Slim only ever had one hit on the R&B charts, and this was not it. The song called Little Rain failed to make the Hot 100. All of Your Love, not a hit on the Billboard R&B charts. Ride 'em on down, not a hit on the Billboard R&B charts. There's a bit of a pattern here, Steve. All of these songs were not hits, failed to go anywhere at the time of release. So that's an interesting decision in itself. They've said, we're just going to go back, we're going to pillage the blues catalogues, come up with a bunch of songs that probably most people have never heard of, and turn that into an album.
Yeah, it's what they call deep cuts, I believe. And you don't get
deep
cuts. And you don't get much deeper than those, do you?
So I think that, for me, that meant that I've listened to it a few times now, and two or three of the songs are beginning to emerge to me as songs I'm going to latch on to. But certainly on the first listening, none of it was a particularly memorable or catchy tune. They were just, you know, blues songs, R&B songs, which you've heard many times before. And yeah, Rolling Stones do a very good version of it. But I think it takes a few listenings to maybe start to really get to grips with it.
Well, it's inaccessible, isn't it?
That's a good way of putting it.
This is blues music for hardcore blues fans. Now, obviously, this being the Rolling Stones, they are played impeccably. You don't get better musicianship. Actually, the only way how do you make a Rolling Stones blues song better? Well, go ahead.
Yes, Scott. No, you go. No, where you go.
No, I tee that one up for you there, mate.
Oh, you find out that Eric Clapton's playing in a studio next door and you rope him in.
Exactly. That's the only way you can make it better. And so they did on a couple of tracks, and they play out very, very well. But still, this is primarily for aficionados. Now, the Rolling Stones haven't released a new album in 11 years.
Yeah.
A bigger bang, about which the less said the better by many people. Was 2005.
Okay, that is a long time ago. Yep.
I do own a copy of it somewhere, and I'm sure I've listened to it, but I wasn't very impressed with it. But but the thing is, they were unmistakably Jagger and Richards compositions. You listen to a Rolling Stones song from anywhere back in their history, and you know who wrote it. You know who's performing it.
Yes.
But that they don't have that unique spark of, yeah, I don't know. I think I'm reaching too hard here.
Not at all. I mean, these guys, maybe it's more Richards, they came up with some of the great guitar riffs of modern music. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And they are not present on this collection of songs. So you are really, as you're quite right, you're sitting there appreciating how they handle what they've been given or what they've chosen, rather than marveling at their own originality. But they do a good job. Jagger's in good voice. It's got a slightly dirty feel to the production, which I guess is what they were aiming for. It's good. But if you're not a blues or R&B fan, you're you're probably not going to take away too much from it.
No, and just one quick profound comment. They say that they recorded this in 3 days. I'd suggest that it's taken them 50 years to make this album.
Oh, yeah.
I'm proud of that line.
Yeah. Very nice, very nice. Okay, so that's Blue and Lonesome for the Rolling Stones. Terms of music coming up, Steve, in the next month or two, we've mentioned a few things over the last few podcasts. We've heard how Adele has sold out and then sold out and then sold out again, and they keep releasing more tickets. And so that she hasn't cancelled, that's good.
Nope.
But there has been a cancellation, hasn't there?
There's been another one. Barry Gibb has cancelled, and apparently the reason given was a change in international commitments. And I'm thinking, seriously, mate, is that the best you can come up with? I mean, we don't know. Was his poor ticket sales? Did he get a better offer elsewhere? Didn't fancy it? I don't know. But yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we had Culture Club cancel last month. John Cleese announced the cancellation of the Fawlty Towers stage show last month. It seems like a lot of people are just like, yeah, we can't be bothered. New Zealand, too far.
Ah, actually, there's an interesting little connection with Barry Gibb coming to this part of the world, Steve. Because, of course, Springsteen's coming in February. Now, in his last trip down under, when he went to both Australia and New Zealand, he did a number of covers of well-known Australian songs. And in the case of New Zealand, he did Lord's Royals, just solo acoustic. But in Australia, in Queensland, he did a fantastic cover of a Barry Gibb song from Saturday Night Fever. And I've forgotten the name of it, but it's the Staying Alive. Sorry,
this is momentary
mental lapse here. Staying Alive, it's fantastic. It's on, if you search it out on YouTube, it's a wonderful cover and interpretation.
I'll have to, because Bruce Springsteen doing the Bee Gees is not something that springs readily to mind.
Well, no, and it's given a very different treatment. And I had this, when I heard Barry Gibb was coming down, I thought, if you could wave a magic wand and bring Gibb on stage while Bruce is doing that version, that would be really something.
That would be remarkable, wouldn't it?
I don't think it's going to happen. But there's lots of other music. There's the big Laneways Festival coming up soon as well, I think.
Yeah, but we're not talking about that one.
No, because we didn't get the access we wanted.
No, we didn't get passes. So even though it's coming, we're not going to talk about it.
No.
Because we're professional like that.
We are. But there'll be one or two acts around, apparently.
There will indeed. And we will, despite ourselves, be giving that a bit more. It's end of January, so we'll be talking about that closer to the time. What else is coming in February, Simon? Anybody big that we know of?
Well, apart from aforementioned Bruce, who, by the way, is in Christchurch as well as Auckland, and the Christchurch show will be potentially... It could be really something, given that there was a lot of clamour last time for him to go there in the wake of the earthquake down there. And the song that became famous after 9/11 that he wrote, My City of Ruins, which was actually written not about New York City, but it was written about his hometown. But nevertheless, I think a lot of people saw that song and saw it being as incredibly appropriate for Christchurch. And he dedicated it to Christchurch when he played in Auckland. 3 years ago, was it three? Two, 3 years ago. So I'm sure he will play it in Christchurch, and that will be quite a moment. So I'm a bit on the Bruce, my Bruce radar is finally honed. Is there anyone else? Oh, I know who you're alluding to, Mr. McCabe.
Who's that?
You're alluding to Guns N' Roses, are you not?
Well, that would be the other big one coming up very shortly.
Yes,
that's
yes,
going to be.
Yes.
They're playing Auckland and Wellington, and they're going to be in Auckland for Waitangi weekend. And that has, from what I've been reading, they're putting on a fantastic show around the world. That's definitely one to be at.
Okay. Do you see yourself getting a photo pass for that one?
Well, I would hope so. Or we shall plug away at that. I think it would be a great one to be at. I think yes. I think it would be fantastic. I would be delighted to get to shoot that one. That and Bruce himself, I think, are at this stage looking like the highlights of next year. But who knows what else is coming?
Yeah. And fans of Adele may want to mention her name in passing. Okay. Hey, well, Steve, I think we should wrap that up. That's going to be our last podcast for this year. So we'll come back early-ish to January. We haven't decided exactly when, but we'll let you know. Just keep following our website, and you can follow what's our timetable is. But we do hope that you do have a great Christmas and New Year, and a safe one and a happy one. And if you want to get in touch with us, of course, you're very, very welcome. We'd love to hear from you, especially what you think of films like Rogue One and Passengers. You can email us, can't they, Steve? I've forgotten the email address.
Crave podcast@cravepodcast.com. Whew. I know.
You can also find us
other ways. How hard is that one to remember, seriously?
For someone who's been talking about it for 2 years, it shouldn't be too hard at all.
I know. you never cease to find new ways to disappoint, do you, Simon?
Oh, God. Anyway.
You'll get emails if you can. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
Lovely. So,
Merry Christmas, Simon.
Yes, and Merry Christmas to you, Steve McCabe. Lovely to be chatting and discussing entertainment with you, and we'll do it again next year.
Looking forward to it.
And that is what's been entertaining us in 2016.
Nice one.